Chapter 15. The doorman of the Sudbury was still on duty despite the lateness of the hour, and, at the sight of a copper from Stoker, summoned the hotel's comfortable brougham for us. I settled in against the velvet squabs, and when the door was closed upon us with the curtains drawn, we were cocooned in a dark and comfortable little nest against the frigid, frosty midnight. I ought to have been exhausted, but I found myself instead exhilarated in an exaltation of spirits I had seldom enjoyed whilst in England. Upon my travels, I was often in the grip of strong emotion, hot upon the trail of an elusive butterfly, or brought up to my highest mettle by the demands of arduous travel. Those experiences sharpened the senses and tested the resolve, resulting in a sense of vitality and purpose difficult to explain to those who choose a more sedate existence. But on my home soil, there were precious few occasions for such keen endeavours. The odd abduction or attempt on my life, and the bouts of physical congress I enjoyed with Stoker, were the only times I had felt that knife-edge of authentic experience, and I revelled in the sudden thrum in my blood. I turned to Stoker, whose eyes gleamed cat-like in the dark. He said nothing, but the growl he emitted was eloquent as any love poem. What followed has no bearing on this narrative, but I will note that the rhythmic movement of a carriage at a brisk trot is most conducive to certain pleasures, so much so that at a particularly sharp moment, Stoker was forced to cover my mouth with his hand to muffle my most forceful exclamations. The fact that in my enthusiasm I unwittingly bit his finger was something I did not discover until I had removed myself from the most suitable position, sitting astride him and using the velvet hanging straps to great effect to secure my balance, and smoothed my skirts back into place. Stoker had tidied his own clothing and sat with his hand wrapped in one of his enormous scarlet handkerchiefs, glowering a little. "Did you not enjoy yourself?" I asked in some surprise. Whilst Stoker's preference was for a lengthy and languorous coupling, accompanied by comfortable beds and extensive recitations of poetry, he could always be relied upon for applying himself with diligence and dexterity to a more vigorous interlude.
"I did," he ground out between gritted teeth, "until you bit me."
He brandished the injured limb, and I apologized prettily.
"I thought you heard my groans of pain," he went on, still sulking.
"I did," I explained, "but I fear I mistook them for the culmination of your pleasure. Your groans all rather sound the same."
"Yes, it did seem to spur you on,"
he added a trifle nastily. "It is hardly my fault if you are inarticulate," I pointed out. "Do attempt to clot faster, Stoker. We have arrived." The carriage drew up at Bishop's Folly, Lord Rosemoran's estate, and we alighted. Stoker clutched the box of chocolates to his chest with his good hand, and it was left to me to pay the coachman. He caught the coin I flipped with a nod.
"Much obliged, madam. I do hope you enjoyed the ride,"
he added, with a wink, as he sprang the horses from the curb.
"Of all the cheek," I muttered. "Did you hear the fellow?"
But Stoker was in no mood for my imprecations against the coachman. He sulked and stormed until I settled him at my little Gothic Folly, building a fire and handing over my best velvet cushion for his head, before passing him a bottle of my favourite aguardiente. I left him to clean his wound himself, on the grounds that I thought he was making rather a tremendous mountain of this particularly small molehill, but once I saw the depth and detail of the bite, I was assailed by guilt. His left index finger was marked by the perfect imprint of my teeth, the flesh scored nearly to the bone and still bleeding freely.
"I am sorry," I told him in true contrition, as I bound the finger in a clean handkerchief. I do not know what came over me.
I do,
he said, sipping thoughtfully at the liqueur.
You are bored.
With you? I cried. You cannot think so. You must not.
I don't, as it happens,
he said dryly.
Your enthusiasm for my person is both comprehensive and much appreciated. But there is something in this fog-shrouded island that dulls the senses.
You feel it also? He gave me a searching look.
Why do you think I rejected everything about the life to which I was bred? I ran away from my father's home when I was little more than a child in search of, I do not know what. Adventure, I suppose. That part of myself that I chased but could never seem to find. I was suffocated in that house, listening to my parents' quarrels and wondering if the whole of my life was meant to be nothing but a repetition of theirs. It was as though they never really lived. That house was merely a stage set, and their lives were theatrical parts played upon it. The angry aristocrat, the long-suffering wife, the servants looking on, and every day the same thing, tea with scones and silences, hatred for dinner, resentment at luncheon. I wanted nothing more than to breathe, to feel something other than that oppression.
I said nothing, and he went on, his voice a little dreamy from the after effects of our vigorous activities and the aguardiente.
And so I left, searching out experiences, both good and bad, and God knows I have found them. The bad were the bombardment in Alexandria, the Amazonian expedition, marrying Caroline, and the good were the friends I found, the kindred spirits I have met along my travels, and who have known me as one of them.
A sudden dart of fear lanced my heart. It thudded awkwardly in my chest. I would hope that I am counted among the good that has happened to you, I said, summoning a smile. He did not return it. He leant forward a little and cupped my chin in the breadth of his palm.
You are not.
The thud in my chest became a hammering, slow and painful on the ribs. Oh, he went on.
You are not among the good that has happened to me. You are the best of all that I have known. You are what I searched for when I left that house and wandered this earth, boy and man. You are the part of myself I never thought to find because I did not even dare to dream you existed. You are all that I want and more than I deserve. And I will go to my grave thanking a God in whom I do not believe for bringing me to you.
I was silent a long moment, but the tears upon my cheeks said everything I could not. Well, I said finally, wiping my cheeks upon my sleeve. It was not Keats, but I suppose as declarations go, it is sufficient. He smiled, a smile of such infinite tenderness that my throat tightened to speechlessness.
I understand you, Veronica, because I am you. I know that England is too small and too safe to contain you, because it confines me as well. Do you think a day does not pass that I do not long to be aboard a ship, salt spray in my face and sails snapping in the wind, bound for the other side of the world? We have known such liberty, such wideness of experience that most can only imagine. And we will know such things again,
he promised.
But I should reconcile myself to the fact that whilst we are here, we must take our adventures where we can.
What do you mean? I asked.
His hand still gripped my chin, and he bent his head to press his brow to my own.
I mean that you ought to change out of your skirts and into a pair of trousers, because we are going to break into the Curiosity Club. Tonight.
I blinked in astonishment. You cannot be serious.
Serious as a parson in a pulpit.
He kissed me soundly upon the mouth and sat back, draining the last of his aguardiente.
Go on, then. It grows late, and we have work to do.
I hurried to the corner, where a chest of drawers and series of pegs had been arranged to hold my wardrobe. A modest screen shielded the corner, and although I had few secrets from Stoker, I stepped behind it, stripping off garments in haste. Explain, I ordered, as I shook out the suit of clothes I had ordered for butterflying. At first glance, it seemed much like an ordinary town suit, a narrow skirt and fitted jacket of becoming and serviceable cut. But upon closer inspection, it was easy to see the fabric was costly and durable thin tweed, and the skirt was layered over a pair of very slim matching trousers, which tucked into flat boots that laced to the knee. I buttoned and laced and tucked whilst Stoker talked.
Amongst Alice Baker Green's possessions is a notebook, her climbing journal,
he said.
I think we need to steal it.
I poked my head around the screen. How did you learn about the journal? I demanded. I know I showed it to you the day we met the princess, but how do you know its significance?
Captain Durand,
he said in obvious satisfaction.
We had a most illuminating discussion whilst he was helping me with my moustaches. Apparently, Alice kept detailed records of her expeditions, including companions. If she meant to climb with someone that morning, she might have made note of it, and it may well lead us to the mustachioed man on the mountain. Besides which, it is a notable coincidence that the princess has disappeared just after we discovered that Alice Baker Green was likely murdered, and I do not like coincidences. Alice apparently wrote at length about the people where she travelled. She may well have recorded something which could lead us to the princess as well.
I emerged from the screen, pulling on a heavy cloak. That was my discovery, I told him in some irritation. I was meant to persuade you that we needed to see the ledger. He shrugged a shoulder.
Perhaps I am better at this investigative business than you are, he said lightly.
How dare you? I began, but then I noted the unholy light in his eyes. You are enjoying this. I think you have always enjoyed this. Being shot and stabbed and nearly drowned, you complain about all of it, yet here you are, herring off in the dead of night to commit some sort of illegal entry into a private club to secure a possible clue after we have nearly been bombed to bits. Do not argue with me, Revelstoke Templeton Vane. I see you for the seeker of thrills that you really are. He rose and picked up his hat, grinning.
Excelsior.
It took a little time to hail a cab in the Marylebone Road, no surprise given the lateness of the hour. Stoker took the precaution of giving an address a street before the Curiosity Club. We wanted no witness to our presence in the vicinity once the theft was inevitably discovered. On the way, we discussed what we knew of the case so far, and my theory that Alice Baker Green might have been eliminated as an obstacle to the Duke's marriage to the princess.
A sound enough idea in theory,
Stoker agreed.
If she was the Duke's mistress.
And why else give her the house intended for Captain Durand? I interjected.
It is certainly a possibility,
he said.
But how could he go so quickly from providing Alice a love nest right under the princess's nose to wanting to kill her?
To ensure his marriage to Gisela, I said promptly. He shook his head.
I do not believe it. If he loved Alice enough to set her up in a house of her own in Hochstadt, in the very shadow of the castle, we are told, then he would not murder her within a few months.
I think you, above all people, would understand the possibility of a relationship going badly awry in a short period of time, I said gently.
Touché. I did myself change from husbandly devotion to incandescent rage within a few months, he acknowledged. But between those times were months of abject sorrow. I had first to recognize that the woman I thought I had married did not exist. I could not hate her until I had learnt to mourn her. You are suggesting something quite different, that Maximilian murdered Alice in cold blood to secure his marriage.
To a princess, I corrected. There is a throne in the equation. You cannot discount the lengths to which a man will go for a crown.
A consort's crown of a tiny, insignificant country, he said. Would any man kill for that? Least of all the woman he loved.
I considered this. It took a betrayal for you to move from love to hatred, I reminded him. Perhaps Maximilian experienced the same.
You mean Alice had a lover besides Maximilian?
Why not? She was a woman of keen independence. She embraced many modern ideas, votes for women, rights for workers. Why not free love as well? Or perhaps she simply fell out of love with him and found someone else. If Maximilian had already gone to the trouble of arranging for her establishment in the Alpenwald, he would be enraged to find himself a laughingstock.
So he killed the woman he loved, either to sacrifice her to his own ambitions or to punish her for failing to return his fidelity?
Both of those are understandable actions if a man is proud, and Duke Maximilian is excessively proud, I pointed out.
As I said, in theory, either explanation makes perfect sense.
However,
I think there is something more we have not yet discovered, and perhaps the answers lie between the covers of Alice's notebook.
I hearkened back to something he had said at Bishop's Folly. Do you really believe there is a connection between Alice's death and Gisela's disappearance?
I cannot imagine what, but it is entirely possible the two events are unrelated.
They had Maximilian in common, I mused. What if he did not remove Alice from the picture, but Gisela herself did?
She had only to order Alice from the Alpenwald, he reminded me. She is the hereditary princess. If she wanted Alice banished, then Alice would go.
But Maximilian, if he was still in love with Alice, might make a good deal of trouble. Would you want to start a marriage on such a footing?
Better than killing my mistress, if that is what you mean.
I lapsed into irritated silence. Their motives are so oblique. I find these people vastly annoying.
Annoying, but interesting,
he said with a smile.
It is a tangled skein, to be sure. Now, let us set to ravelling.
Naturally, there ensued a rather spirited discussion on which of us ought to break into the Curiosity Club. We stood on the pavement, tucked into the leafy shadows of the square across the street. The club had once been a private residence, deeded to the organization by one of the founding members. It stood in a quiet street not so very far from a royal palace.
The houses that stood like sentinels around the square were tastefully embellished and uncompromisingly white. Austere wedding cakes, I always thought of them. During the day, the square would hum with discreet activity, nannies pushing their charges in perambulators buffed to a perfect gloss, maid servants moving on silent feet, starched aprons and cap ribbons snapping behind them. There were 100 such streets in London, each of them pristine and tidy and secure in their own respectable prosperity. It seemed nothing scandalous or criminal could ever happen in such a place, except that we were currently bent upon thievery. We argued in hushed tones as we surveyed the building that housed the Curiosity Club. Stoker pointed out his greater skills in the art of lockpicking, to say nothing of shinning up a drainpipe like a monkey, a product of years spent in circus tents and on naval ships. But I replied that his skills were entirely immaterial in this case. "I have a key," I told him, brandishing the article in question.
"Veronica, you cannot just bloody well walk inside and steal Alice's notebook,"
he protested. "Of course I can. I am a member of the club, and you are not even the proper gender to be allowed inside its hallowed walls. I shall enter and slip upstairs to the exhibition room. If I am detected, I will simply say that I have come at Lady C's behest to attend to a detail regarding the exhibition, and that the hour may be unconventional, but was the only time I could spare."
"And what if Lady C is the one who apprehends you?"
he demanded. "That is a river I will ford when I come to it," I told him. I lifted up on tiptoe and kissed his cheek. "Stay in the shadows and try not to look quite so menacing, or someone will report you to the police as a lurker." He grumbled something entirely unprintable in a polite memoir, and I hurried off, drawing in great lungfuls of cold, crisp London air. The door of the Curiosity Club sat in a tiny pool of warm light from the gas lantern hung next to it. Around me were silent shadows. In this quiet and largely residential part of the city, there were only houses and private clubs barred to outsiders. Even the garden in the centre of the square was locked and barred against those who did not belong. Stoker had moved backwards to conceal himself still further against the high iron gate of the garden in the square, and I could not see him as I moved on careful feet to the top of the stone steps and fitted my key to the lock. I gave a soft call, the cry of the hoopoe, and our arranged signal. One call for success and two for danger. I waited for Stoker's answering call and slipped into the club, closing the door silently behind me and thanking Providence for Hestia. As portress, she was a ferocious guardian at the gate and took exquisite care of the property as well as the organization itself. Her exacting standards meant that there were no creaking hinges, no groaning floorboards to betray my presence. Inside the hall, a nightlight burned, a single gas jet illuminating the interior. I groped my way up the stairs, keeping one hand lightly on the stair rail as I moved, fingertips skimming the freshly polished wood. It smelt strongly of beeswax and lavender. I forced myself to move slowly, advancing a step with each new breath, willing my heartbeat to calmness. The walls were thickly hung with paintings and photographs, framed maps and expedition gear. The last thing I needed was to upset one of them and send something crashing down to rouse the household. Hestia slept on the premises, I recalled, and there were a few rooms always reserved for members who did not live in London, but wished to use the club as a sort of base camp whilst in the city. Heaven only knew how many women might be sleeping under that roof while I crept about, but my plan was to leave them to their slumbers. The door to the exhibition room was unlocked. As I turned the knob, I heard a soft noise. A footfall?
a snore, and instantly stopped, standing as still as one of Stoker's stuffed specimens. I waited an eternity, but there was no further noise, only the occasional gentle creak of an old house settling its bones against the icy weather. After 1,000 heartbeats, I slipped inside the room, shutting the door gently behind me. I took the precaution of turning the key in the lock and slipping it into my pocket. Without it, there would be a delay of several hours at least before anyone was able to gain access to the room and discover the theft of the notebook. I was conscious at once of how cold it was in the room, far colder than the rooms downstairs, and I shivered as I crossed the carpet to the display case where the notebook had been locked. It was darker here as well. No nightlight softened the darkness, and the heavy draperies had been drawn across the window. It was a large French window, giving on to a small balustraded parapet that overhung the ground floor, making the house far more attractive than the buildings with flat facades, I thought, but desperately draughty in winter, it seemed. The draperies even stirred a little in the chill of the night air, and I realized I could, quite possibly, leave that way, eliminating the need for a return trip through the club. All it required was a convenient bit of ivy, or even a few architectural embellishments upon which to place my weight. I was no climber in the fashion of Alice Baker Green, or even as skilled as Stoker in such matters. But butterflying required considerable scrambling over rocks, hauling oneself up and down steeply scrubby hillsides and modest mountains. I had more than once launched myself into ravines or over a precipice, and the thought of doing so under these conditions caused my pulse to quicken with excitement. So distracted was I by such thoughts that once I struck a vesta, the burst of light blooming into the darkness and dazzling my eyes, I did not realize at first that the door of the case stood open, a twisted wire lodged in the lock. On the shelf where the notebook had been left, there was only an empty place. I like to think that my wits might have functioned more quickly had my eyes not taken a moment to adjust to the change in light, but the truth was, I had approached the endeavour far too complacently. When I am coursing along the trail of a most elusive butterfly, I must still be watchful, vigilant against poisonous vipers, assorted venomous spiders, rockfalls and sinking sands, and the occasional brigand. In the cushioned security of the Curiosity Club, those lessons deserted me, and I did not scent danger until it was upon me. The drapery at the window bellied out with a sudden frosty gust, and I realized too late that the window was not poorly fitted and draughty. It was open. The gust caused my vesta to gutter and die, just as a figure launched itself at me from behind the drapery. I had but a fragment of a second's warning. I dodged to my right, eluding the heaviest part of the blow, but still a solid strike from a closed fist landed upon my jaw, hurtling me to the ground and causing stars to sparkle across my vision. Without thought or hesitation, I forced myself up onto my hands and knees, in time to see the intruder flee through the open window, pausing only briefly, entangled in the thick curtain before vanishing out the window and onto the parapet. Our collision had cost me a second or two at most, and by the time I reached the parapet, the villain had only just swung a leg over the side of the balustrade. The figure was male, with a cap pulled low over the brow, concealing the features. The head turned, the shadowed eyes seeming to bore into me, and then he was gone, as silent and weightless as if he had dropped from the parapet. I vaulted to where he had disappeared, to find he had not, in fact, fallen, but was climbing swiftly and quietly, with an economy of motion that would have done credit to an orangutan. I swung my leg over the parapet, giving a double-barreled cry of the hoopoe,
two quick calls to alert Stoker to danger. The figure looked up as I secured my hold on the drainpipe. The apparatus swung alarmingly under our combined weight, but it held, the bolts biting into the masonry of the building as we descended. He hit the ground at a dead run, his boots making a peculiar metallic noise as he moved. There was no sign of Stoker, and I cursed him roundly under my breath as I undertook the pursuit myself. The stranger ran across the street towards the square, hauling himself hand over hand up the iron bars and into the garden, disappearing into the thick foliage.
"What in the name of the oozing wounds of Christ is happening?"
Stoker demanded, as I pounded on the bars in frustration. "The devil has gone in there," I exclaimed. "He has the notebook." Stoker, to his eternal credit, required no further urging. He dropped at once to his knee, forming a stirrup with his hands. He rested these on his thigh, and as I set my foot into his cupped palms, he surged upwards, vaulting me up and over the top of the fence. He followed hard upon my heels, both of us landing rather gracelessly in a particularly nasty evergreen shrub. We helped one another to our feet, stopping to listen. There was no noise save the sigh of the wind and the click of the bare branches of the plane trees overhead as they rubbed together.
"He cannot be far," I whispered. "His boots make noise, metallic."
"Climbing boots," Stoker said grimly. "Nails in the soles, no doubt."
I nodded and peered into the darkness. Only a sliver of a waning crescent moon illuminated the sky, giving nothing but a cold, faraway glow to the rooftops beyond the garden. Of the square itself, it showed nothing, and there were no friendly lanterns to light the way. It seemed impossible that one could be in the heart of London and yet so completely silent. But we were as remote as that silvery, slivery moon, I thought. But then I knew, although I could not have said why. Our miscreant was close at hand. I turned to Stoker. "We have lost him," I said, in audible dejection. "And I cannot stand any longer in this freezing cold. We might as well go home." Stoker opened his mouth to protest, but I pressed his hand.
Oh, yes, quite right. It is devilishly cold, and I think I am taking a chill."
He gave a racking cough that was as false as it was loud, and I tugged on his hand, pulling him towards the gate. "Have you your lockpicks handy? I've no liking for going over that fence again, and it would be far more comfortable to leave by the gate."
"Yes, of course."
We dared not light a vesta, so he worked by touch, taking a little longer than he might otherwise have done. I was conscious the whole time of a presence, nothing more than a feeling. Not by footstep or rustling branch did he betray his presence, but I knew he was there. When the gate was at last open, I motioned for Stoker to go through first. He eased himself out onto the pavement, looking for any passers-by, but he shook his head, indicating the streets were quiet. I tested the gate on its hinges, finding it silent and smooth, and opened it widely.
"Thank God this night is over," I said with a yawn, and I gestured for Stoker to walk a little ways down the pavement, his footfalls echoing around the silent square.
I stood in the shadow for a long minute, so long I began to think our quarry would never emerge. But at last I heard the peculiar metallic scrape of his boots on the gravel, coming closer and closer still as my hand gripped the gate. He stepped onto the pavement, and I flung the gate forward with all my might, the end post catching him squarely upon the chin and knocking him flat onto his back as his feet soared over his head. Stoker was at my side in an instant.
I presume you had an excellent reason for doing that?
He asked mildly. He hit me in the jaw, I said, tapping the spot on my face that I was quite certain would bloom with a bruise by morning.
Well then, Stoker replied, you ought to have hit him harder.
He is unconscious, I pointed out. I was not trying to kill him. Stoker lit a series of vestas to illuminate the scene as I bent swiftly to the villain's recumbent form and searched his pockets. The notebook was in the second, and I handed it to Stoker for safekeeping. I might have proved myself a match for the fellow, but I had little doubt he would think twice before attacking Stoker.
Who do you think it is?
Stoker asked, as he buttoned the notebook securely into his pocket. His vesta struggled against the chill wind, giving only a small pool of light, and the miscreant's face was still concealed by his scarf and cap. I shrugged. It has all been too confusing to venture a guess. Maximilian, perhaps? Just then the villain groaned and moved his head.
What in the name of Sam Hill did you do that for?
He demanded. He sat up, his scarf falling away. But even if I had not glimpsed the features, I would have known him from the American idiom. Douglas Norton, I cried. Chapter 16. Douglas Norton gave another groan and dropped his head into his hands.
It feels like my head is about to fall off,
he complained as he raised his face to Stoker.
What did you hit me with?
I did not hit you at all, my good fellow, Stoker replied. That is the lady's handiwork.
Norton gave a soundless whistle.
That was as hard a hit as any I've taken,
he said, with something that might have been respect. Well, you did hit me first, I pointed out. He had the grace to look embarrassed.
You surprise me, and I am not exactly experienced at breaking and entering. Good,
Stoker said, hauling him to his feet.
Then you will not mind coming with us for a little conversation on the matter.
With one hand on Norton's collar and the other on his belt, he propelled the fellow forward and around the corner, in the direction whence he had come as I had been busily flinging myself down a drainpipe. Stoker stopped next to a green cabman's shelter, one of the tidy little chalets that had been built for the comfort and security of the city's drivers, to keep them from cold and wind and the lure of drink whilst they waited for fares. The chimney smoked gently, and there was a convivial sound of scraping cutlery and manly conversation within. Gas lanterns hung outside over window boxes that must have bloomed with good cheer in warmer months. Now they were empty and forlorn, but the shelter provided a little respite from the wind, and the lanterns illuminated our strange party. We cannot take him in there, I protested. The shelters are for cabmen only. They are quite strict upon the matter.
I know,
Stoker said, pushing Norton up against the wall of the shelter. The thump of Norton's body hitting the wall must have echoed inside, for the door opened and a round, ruddy face wreathed in ginger whiskers peered out.
Back again, are you, Mr. Stoker?
I am, Tom. I need a few minutes' private conversation with the gentleman. You don't mind?
The fellow flapped a meaty hand.
Lord love you, no. If you need a hand, I'll bring the lads, I will. Otherwise, I shall leave you to get on with it.
He gave a nod and withdrew into the snug warmth of the cab shelter, taking with him the aroma of bacon and new bread and horse. Stoker turned to Norton, who had been furtively examining his pockets.
You took it, didn't you?
Norton's expression was a mask of fury. Of course we did.
I told him, and there is no purpose in trying to get it back. We will only strike you again. He held up his hands as if to ward us off.
I think we've had enough fisticuffs for one night, but what do you want with Alice's journal?
What do you want with it? I countered.
If you know who I am, you will know what I want with it,
he said flatly.
Her professional notes,
Stoker guessed.
Her routes up and down the most challenging climbs in the world. All the secrets of one of the most accomplished alpinists ever to set foot on a mountain.
Norton's expression struggled between anger and misery.
You've no idea what it's like, trying to make a name for yourself as a climber these days. You've either got to have family money or a rich sponsor to pay the way, and those are as scarce as hen's teeth.
Alice Baker Green managed to secure a few, I reminded him.
She did,
he said with real bitterness.
She had only to smile at a camera and they came flocking to her. It took me 2 years to find a sponsor of my own, a Colorado miner who had struck it rich and liked to spread his money around. He gave me a partial share for a season and said he would give me enough for the Karakoram if I distinguished myself. Distinguished? That's a laugh. What happened?
Stoker asked.
I went climbing with Alice Baker Green and lost my sponsor because she kicked up a fuss and said I beat her to the summit in violation of our agreement.
He rubbed at his jaw, drawing his fingers away to look at the blood streaming from his chin. Did you, or did she lie? I demanded. His gaze met mine and then shifted.
I hardly like to say. It was a difficult and dangerous time on that mountain. A storm had risen. We were out of provisions and Alice was faltering. She wanted to rest, and I thought she meant to turn back afterwards. She said later that she made it plain she intended to try for the summit, but I never heard that. It was screaming blue murder with wind on that mountain.
He added,
impossible to hear anything, really.
So your climbing partner was, you believed, in difficulty and without provisions, in dangerous conditions, and your solution was to abandon her in order to secure your own glory? I made my tone as pleasant as possible, but he bristled.
When you put it like that, it sounds bad.
It is bad, I assured him, and your reputation suffered accordingly, so much so that you have scarcely been on a mountain since, unless you count the Alpenwald. He flinched as if I had hit him again.
I was never in the Alpenwald. Really?
Stoker said.
I seem to recall a newspaper piece suggesting you were. That is slander,
he said stoutly.
Or libel, whichever. It is a filthy lie.
In spite of the cold, tiny beads of perspiration beaded his hairline. Attempting to summit the Teufelstrepper in order to prove your merit as a climber seems a perfectly reasonable and worthwhile thing to do, I suggested, and nothing worth flinging accusations of libel and slander about, unless you were really in the Alpenwald for a more nefarious purpose.
Like cutting Alice Baker Green's rope and pushing her to her death,
Stoker finished. Douglas Norton's eyes rounded and his mouth fell slack.
What are you talking about?
We are talking about the murder of Alice Baker Green, I said.
Murder? It was an accident,
he said, thrusting his hands through his hair. His cap fell off and he left it on the pavement.
Oh, no.
His voice fell to a series of soft, desperate murmurs.
No, it cannot be. I assure you it is,
Stoker told him.
I cannot believe it was murder,
Norton said. The inquest was not privy to certain evidence we have uncovered, I replied,
Evidence that makes it quite clear Alice was murdered, and most likely by a slender man with moustaches, I added, flicking the end of his with a finger. Moustaches just like these. He drew back sharply.
I had nothing to do with her death, he said. I didn't even know she had been murdered until just this minute. And I suppose you also had nothing to do with another burglary of the club,
Stoker said, nodding towards the direction of the club. Norton blinked.
What burglary?
Two nights ago, I said. Someone broke in and stole the rope which Alice was using the day she died, a rope that had been deliberately cut. I did not mention the badge. It seemed best to hold back at least a little of the story.
And a rope which was the single best indicator that she was murdered,
Stoker added.
I had nothing to do with that either,
Norton said, his eyes darting desperately. And yet here you are, I told him in a pleasant tone, playing the thief and stealing something that belonged to Alice Baker Green. What else have you stolen, Mr. Norton? It was a mistake, I reflected, as he thrust himself suddenly away from the wall of the shelter and took off as if the hounds of hell were after him, his nailed climbing boots striking sparks on the pavement as he ran. Stoker heaved a sigh.
Shall I fetch him back?
I shook my head. We have the notebook, and that is all that matters. I bent to the pavement and retrieved Norton's cap. Inside the band there was a small card bearing the name of a rather unsavory lodging house in Clerkenwell. Besides, we know where to find him if we want him, I added.
Just as well,
Stoker said with a broad yawn.
I doubt he is our miscreant of two nights past.
I whirled on him. How on earth can you think him innocent?
Because I had a delightful little chat with Ginger Tom.
Ginger Tom?
The cabman. He used to be a draftsman, driving wagons for the circus. He took his brother's hackney when he died and moved his family to London. Our paths occasionally cross,
he told me.
I knew this was his favourite shelter, so I thought I would look in on the chance he might be here.
You were supposed to be keeping watch outside the club, I reminded him coldly.
Empires have fallen in the time it took you,
he replied.
I meant only to ask him a question or two about the night Alice's rope and badge were stolen from the club.
And? He shook his head.
I know you would dearly love for him to have driven the guilty party to their breaking and entering and provide us with a solid description, but I am afraid he was not here that night.
I swore fluently, bringing a smile to Stoker's lips.
However,
he said, holding up a hand,
no chambermaid ever gossiped as much as a cabman. One of his mates was bringing a fare back late that night and saw two people on the pavement. There is nothing to indicate they had anything to do with the theft of Alice's things, but they were behaving quite furtively, the fellow said.
Two people? I considered this. I suppose it might have been Norton working with someone. Maximilian? Captain Durand? Stoker shook his head.
I am afraid not. The man was wearing his collar turned up to his cheekbones, he told me. Impossible to describe him at all. But the second...
He paused to heighten my interest.
The second was a woman.
We discussed this development at length as we made our way back to Bishop's Folly, courtesy of Ginger Tom. He dropped us at the gate, neatly catching the coin Stoker flipped and saluting us with his whip as he whistled softly to the horse to walk on. We entered the grounds just as the clock above the stables was chiming the hour.
I gave a broad yawn. Heavens, that's half the night gone, I murmured. Stoker's reply was a few words of Keats nuzzled into my temple as he walked me to the door of my chapel. He left me there, saluting with the hand still wrapped in his handkerchief, and I stared after him, conscious of a rush of emotion the likes of which I could never remember feeling before.
You are all that I want, and more than I deserve, and I will go to my grave thanking a God in whom I do not believe for bringing me to you.
I was still smiling when I fell asleep. The next day I slept rather later than was my custom, not unusual given our nocturnal adventures. The morning was well advanced and bitterly cold by the time I had washed and dressed and applied an ointment of arnica to my bruised chin. Stoker was already in the Belvedere, surrounded by the bevy of dogs, looking hopefully at the heap of bacon on his plate. He was reading the Daily Harbinger and breaking off bits of rind to throw to them. His finger was neatly bandaged and only a little swollen, I saw with relief. Good morning, I said brightly. Anything of interest? Amusement twitched the corners of his mouth.
Only this?
He lifted the newspaper to show me the front page. Princess attacked by prankster outside Opera House, trumpeted the headline. It was accompanied by a few lurid sketches of the pandemonium outside the Opera House and an official portrait of Gisela, complete with crown and royal orders. Prankster! I exclaimed as I leant forward to read the article. It was a breathless account of the entire evening, from the triumph of Mademoiselle Fribourg in her debut as Atalanta to the enthusiastic reception of the Princess of the Alpenwald. After a full page of this, the story turned to the drama that had played out upon the pavement. It went on at great length, describing the event and quoting Inspector Mornaday of Special Branch of the Metropolitan Police, who characterised the event as nothing more than an ill-timed and nasty joke, perpetrated by a japester who had vanished into the crowd. It concluded with a statement from the Alpenwalder delegation that they were perfectly content that this had been a prank and not a serious attempt upon the princess's life. It seems Mornaday has come to the same conclusion you did, I said, tossing the newspaper back to Stoker.
There were no injuries and little damage apart from a few torn garments and broken feathers in the jostling from the panic, he replied. It was the obvious conclusion. Even Mornaday could not fail to draw it, and the Chancellor's statement would prevent him from investigating further, even if he were so inclined.
He will not like that, I mused. I produced the card from the chocolate box and examined it again. Prepare for your end. Ominous.
And timely,
Stoker added, forking up a kidney for Huxley.
A threat like that appearing around the same time as her disappearance and the bomb at the Opera House? Not a coincidence, I think.
A squib, I reminded him. As you so cleverly deduced, it would have no doubt made a powerful effect, receiving a threat like that, coupled with the fright of the explosion.
Did she bolt because she received it?
He wondered aloud, as Huxley nibbled daintily at the fork. I shook my head. I had a good think and remembered something I ought to have recalled earlier. The seal on the chocolates was unbroken when the Baroness offered the box to me. Gisela never saw the threat.
So she did not disappear because it unnerved her,
he said, offering a titbit to Bettany. Under his elbow, Newt sidled up to his plate and lifted off a poached egg.
Why then did she leave? And why is the Chancellor so certain there is no cause to worry about her?
Perhaps he knows where she is,
I ventured. He does seem the least anxious of the lot of them. I helped myself to a piece of toast from the rack and spread it liberally with quince preserves. So what can we infer?
That Gisela is being threatened but not harmed. The chocolates carry only a paper threat, but no real danger, it seems.
Stoker said, scratching Vespertine gently behind the ears.
Of course, the chocolates I ate seemed fine, but I suppose we ought to investigate the rest in case any have been tampered with.
I shook my head. I examined them carefully first thing this morning. There is no sign they have been adulterated, no discoloration, no peculiar odours, no marks of hypodermic syringes or seams where the chocolates may have been opened and put back together.
Very well. We will assume the chocolates and the squib were meant to frighten, but nothing more. To what end?
To force her to leave, I guessed.
Which she has.
But she never saw them, I pointed out.
Perhaps they were not the first.
He shook his head.
It's a damnable puzzle. The only thing we can be certain of is that they are being perpetrated by someone who does not know Gisela has vanished.
Because otherwise, why carry them out? I agreed. So someone outside the Alpenwalder entourage. And that might be anyone, including our favourite investigative journalist. He grunted his agreement and pushed his chair back, slapping his thighs for Newt to jump onto his lap before giving me a searching look.
You do not really believe JJ would do such a thing?
I do not know what to believe, I said evenly.
Veronica, I know she is a difficult person to like at times, but I find it hard to believe she would stoop to such depths.
Do you? I wonder. She is ambitious and intelligent, and her career has been thwarted by the mediocrity of lesser men. What if she felt pressed to produce a story so gripping that her editors were forced to take her back? It mightn't feel like much of a crime to introduce a small card with a few words into a box of chocolates. She must know any number of miscreants willing to hurl a small explosive, particularly if she stressed that the thing was to be harmless. And she is on hand. He sighed, rubbing Newt's ears gently until the dog gave a little sigh of contentment.
You are correct in that it is a good theory, but I cannot believe it.
I rose and dropped a kiss to his head. Your trouble, Revelstoke Templeton Vane, is that you are too sweetly naive where women are concerned. His laughter was still ringing in my ears when I left him. As soon as I had finished my toast and dealt with the most pressing of our correspondence, I turned my attention to Alice Baker Green's notebook. I might have had to fight Stoker for the privilege, but he had been the delighted recipient of a gift. His brother, Tiberius, taking his leisure in Paris, had paid a visit to Desrolles, the temple of natural history on the left bank, where he encountered a rare trophy of a roseate spoonbill.
Platalea ajaja,
Stoker happily informed me.
I have not seen one of these beauties since I was in South America.
He fell at once to studying the quality of the mount, and would likely not have noticed had I divested myself of all my garments and done a dance to shame Salome. So I quietly collected the notebook and retired to my desk, with a good reading lamp and a quantity of paper for taking notes. The notebook was far denser than I had realised, the leaves being the thinnest vellum imaginable, and each page written in a tiny hand, quite unlike Alice's usual bold style. She had devised a sort of shorthand for herself that took many pages to decipher,
and even then, much of it was unintelligible to anyone not familiar with the intricacies of alpinism. There were coordinates and materials lists, sketches of routes and notes on traverses and conditions. It was as thorough a record as I had ever seen, both scientific and personal, and I vowed to see it returned to the Curiosity Club in perfect condition, so that others might benefit from its contents. I also roundly cursed the hide of Douglas Norton for very nearly making off with it, no doubt ensuring it would be lost to mountaineering history if he had been successful. Most of this material I skimmed past, recognizing my own limitations in interpreting the data she had recorded, but I paused to read more closely her paragraphs on the people she encountered on her travels. She was unflinching in her assessments, detailing flaws and foibles as fluently as she did favors and virtues. From the dates inside the cover, I deduced this was not the notebook she had carried during the expedition in which she made such an enemy of Douglas Norton, much to my irritation. I should have thoroughly enjoyed reading her acerbic comments about him. But it began some year and a half before, just about the time she had decided to settle in the Alpenwald. There were frequent mentions of trips from Hochstadt to various mountain towns in the vicinity in Switzerland and Italy, short climbing expeditions in small, out-of-the-way villages, often accompanied by the notation, "climbing with D," or "lazy day with D." These mentions were always finished with a tiny sketch of a flower. I peered through my magnifying glass at the distinctive little petals and realized they were meant to be St. Otild's wort. "D is an Alpenwalder," I murmured to Vespertine. My hound had taken up his post next to my chair, laying the broad weight of his head upon my feet as I worked. Whenever I spoke to him, he raised his shaggy brows before subsiding again into a deep slumber. "But who?" I wondered. "Durand? Possible, but he is meant to marry Yelena, unless he found his attentions wandering. And surely she does not mean Douglas Norton," I said with a snort. Vespertine snuffled in his sleep as if to agree. I reached for the Rosmoren copy of Twistleton's Continental, a compendium of European nobility that ran to some 40 volumes. The Alpenwald was in the first, and it took only a moment to find the entry for Duke Maximilian. "Maximilian Detlef Reinhard Luitpold von Hochstadt, Duke of Lokendorf," I read aloud to Vespertine. Detlef, or Duke, either began with a D. On a whim, I turned a few pages to the entry for the Chancellor, running my finger down the page until I came to his paragraph. "Dagobert," I said, snapping the book closed decisively. "It appears every man who knew Alice is a candidate." I replaced the volume and returned to the notebook with a sigh of irritation. As I reached for it, the book slipped a little, and my fingernail caught on the endpaper, tearing the corner. It was marbled stuff, Florentine and heavy, and I swore under my breath for damaging it. But when I inspected it more closely, I could see that I had not torn it at all. Rather, my nail had slid beneath the edge of the endpaper where it had been pasted down, cracking it free of the spine of the book. I took it nearer the lamp to assess how easily I might glue the endpaper back again, but as I held it to the light, I noticed the endpaper stood very slightly proud of the cover in the center. Something had been pasted inside it, I realized. I took up my paper knife, a dagger I had liberated from the Rosmoren collection. It had once stabbed a Venetian nobleman, but I employed it for a far more quotidian purpose. I slipped the blade beneath the edge of the endpaper, levering it gently, ever so gently. The paper resisted, then came away, bit by bit, until I laid it back, revealing a single page, folded carefully. I extracted it and opened it cautiously. I had expected a letter, perhaps, something romantic, maybe a bit of poetry or a few sentences of passionate declaration. Instead, it was a sketch, detailed and done with skill and exquisite care. Noted at the bottom was the word dolcezza, and I laughed aloud. The word meant sweetness in Italian, and suddenly I understood the reason for all the climes in Italy and Switzerland. D. I studied the sketch for several minutes, realizing I was doubtless the first person to have seen this since Alice had pasted it into her notebook. The notebook she had carried with her everywhere. The notebook that had been with her when she died. "I am glad," I said quietly. "I am glad you had a little happiness." I was still looking at the sketch when Stoker left off playing with his spoonbill and came to look over my shoulder. He glanced, then peered closely with astonished eyes.
"Veronica, why is there a nude sketch of you in Alice Baker Green's notebook?"
"Because that is not me," I told him. "It is Princess Gisela."